Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome back to Inside the Hive. What a very special holiday episode. I'm Emily Jane Fox. I'm here with my co-host and my full friend, Joe Hagan. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. Happy holidays. This season, I've been thinking a lot about not just surviving Christmas, but now that we have the Omicron closing in, and we're all very concerned about suddenly are we going to be isolated again. Right. Whereas I was having a little bit of a social life for the past few weeks. And now that's seeming like maybe a bad idea to do indoors. And we're kind of, I was so bummed when I started reading the paper. And, you know, this is a time where I've had to really go back to remembering how to be mindful, to have mindfulness, to kind of like achieve some sort of peace with where we're at, because it's not ideal. Right. I think about our advertisers that we've had for the last several months. I'm sure you've noticed this, but it's Headspace, right? The meditation app. We have BetterHelp to help you find a therapist. Mm-hmm. People have incredible anxiety right now. I just was reading in the paper, you know, they surveyed all these therapists across the country, and they just say it's like a shit show out there. You know, just a total meltdown everywhere. All their clients are just freaking the hell out. And, you know, there's a lot of all of which is to say, forget all that for now. But I've had to develop my own practice of like relaxation and mindfulness and how do I kind of deal.
What's that practice?
Well, that's listening to music. So for me, it's been about just sort of like mindful listening, just like, you know, often we put music on and it's in the background. And I try to put it into the foreground and just let it kind of carry me out of myself. You know, that's what music at its best can do that.
Sure.
And, you know, it's a Christmas song. Some of them are all right. Little Drummer Boy, I've always had a place in my heart for Little Drummer Boy, the tune. You remember the classic Bing Crosby.
Not the drummer boy himself.
Not him himself, although I always related to him. I always sort of projected myself into the Little Drummer Boy, that I'd be playing the drums.
Well, now every time I hear that, I'm going to think of you as the Little Drummer Boy.
Yeah. But, well, before I get into that any further into this thought, what do you do? You know, to kind of calm yourself. You go running.
Running is my thing. I run every day if I can help it. And it's not really like a physical thing for me. It's a mental thing. And if I don't run, I am a worse person for it. It really is my time that is only for me, that I either work stuff out or I don't. I choose to go inward or I don't. And it's just a block of time that I could think if I want to think or not think if I don't want to think. And it's because I have committed to it every day, it is just a point for me to just like assess where I am. It's a really good mind-body connection for me. And it is essential for my mental health. And it is just, it's kind of a non-negotiable, and I work my day in life around that non-negotiable. And I've been doing that for a really long time. Finding something that allows you to either turn your brain off or turn it on and give you that choice to either go inward or not is essential. And that may not be the same thing for everybody. I think it is absolutely vital at this point in time. I think you're right that there is so much anxiety right now, so much how could we be going back into the dark place again? We were just getting a taste of it. I feel so much anxiety again, just about you know, everyone we know seems to either have COVID now or have been exposed to COVID now, and it's a scary thing. Plans are being canceled. So the anxiety is real. It's palpable. It's understandable. And I think because we're going into this little bit of pause, those of us who are lucky enough to have some days off of work right now, and because this is generally a reflective period of time where people set resolutions and goals, I don't know that like the incremental, like I'm going to drink less, I'm going to work out more, that those are proven to be effective ways to set a resolution. But if we all commit to thinking about how can I make myself feel better in 2022, or commit to myself, what are the small either changes in mindset or changes in behavior that I want to at least test out? You don't have to say I'm going to work out 7 days a week in 2022, or I'm going to stop eating refined sugar, or I'm going to get 9 hours of sleep every night. Those things you're committing to too much. You're biting off more than you can chew. And you don't even know if those are going to serve you, right? So I think if you say, I want to test out getting into bed a half hour earlier in January, that's manageable, right? And I think if you just commit to a short amount of time, they say it takes what, 4 weeks to make a habit. So try something out for 4 weeks. And if you like it, if it feels like it could fit into your life, if it makes you feel better, it makes you think better, it makes you whatever, then keep it going. You probably have created a habit if it serves you. And if it doesn't serve you, you gave up 4 weeks of your life to something that you thought might, what's the worst that could happen?
Well, I think that's great advice. And basically coming up with some practice that you can do on the reg and that makes you feel like you have carved out some space for peace of mind.
My practice that I want to try out is I have a loftier goal that I don't want to get into, but my actual practice is I want to get into bed earlier. Uh-huh. And we get into bed way too late and I set myself up for failure. I'm a terrible sleeper. So if what I said to Leah is, let's aim to get into our bed an hour earlier than we do right now. And we can still watch TV. We can answer emails. I know Ariana Huffington would be like literally stone me for suggesting using electronics in our bedroom, but this is why I'm saying an achievable thing.
I like this.
And we're going to test it out in January.
Yeah.
And then that's going to be what we do. And maybe it'll stick. Maybe it won't. Maybe it'll stick 30% of the time. Maybe it'll stick 70% of the time. But that's what we're doing over here.
Oh, man. I am pro sleep. And I'm pro going to bed early. And I have to say that I have, as somebody who ends up basically going to bed at like 9:30 every night, you know, it's really, it's necessary now. You know, I need to have that full rich, you know, 7 hours at least.
You'd be upset if you knew what time we got into bed up here.
I mean, not always. Sometimes I stay up too late, and I did last night, in fact. But generally, I've been getting to bed early, and it's been a huge thing. But as you know, I am like a vinyl junkie, right? I'm a person mm-hmm. that has a giant record collection. It's a little out of control and a little embarrassing. But mm-hmm. I just wanted to say that what's interesting, you know, there's a vinyl resurgence and they're selling them like hotcakes. And a lot of people are going to have record players under their trees this year, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And the vinyl pressing plants are all backed up because Adele orders like, you know, 50,000 records on vinyl and all the other bands can't even get their records pressed. And this is like an actual thing.
Oh, my God.
But
wow.
The reason I think it's an the reason I love it and why it's been so essential for me is kind of the nature of the format, which is you put it on and you have 15 minutes and then you get up and you turn it over and you have 15 minutes. And when something is on spinning on a machine with the needle on it, you tend to pay attention to it. Unlike if you just told Alexa to turn it on and turn it off, which is different, right? This is like
yes.
a process of like putting something on a platter. You put the needle on. Okay, now I've committed, you know, to this 15 minutes because at the end of it, I got to lift the needle, right? And for me, mm-hmm. just the forced, you know, kind of attention paying, you know, the deep listening, the consciousness of music and listening to it, and I enjoy it anyway, has been such a kind of a meditation practice all of its own. And I listen to, you know, 2 or 3 records a day just because that's my habit. But Which is all of which is to say, when I was thinking about what I wanted for Christmas, is an episode of Inside the Hive that I could indulge my, sweet tooth for music and have somebody on the podcast who is a great fan and appreciator of music and somebody who has a deep knowledge of it and a deep feeling for it. And that's why I invited Don Was onto the program. And I could tell you why. I mean, he's a famed record producer. He's worked with the Rolling Stones, Elvis Costello, Ringo Starr, John Mayer, you know, on and on and on. He's won 4 Grammys. He's like a big guy in the music business.
The real deal.
And now he is the president of Blue Note Records, which is the most vaunted, famous jazz record label in America. I could list all the people on that label, but I won't. But essentially, I asked him, hey, dream up some tracks that you would want to hear during this holiday season, not just Christmas ones, but just ones that make us feel good, things that you can tip us to, right, and make us feel good. And he said he'd be happy to do it. And so we're going to talk, and he's going to queue up songs, and we're going to create a playlist, which we will give you the address of at the end of this podcast.
Cool.
Yeah. And so then, you know, when you're feeling a little lonely or feeling a little cheery or which, you know, it's either Blue Christmas or Jingle Bells, whichever side of the spectrum you want to be on, we'll have something for you here and just it'll occupy your time. And maybe it's some, you know, the practice of listening to it will make you feel good for a little while. So that's the idea.
Well, also the opportunity to be inside someone else's brain and to hear what makes them feel good. Sometimes can get you out of yours, and it can inspire you to be out of your head for a second. I find sometimes I'm just so sick of both my own music and my own thoughts that having the chance to have someone else's music and thoughts feels like a vacation.
Yeah, for sure. So this is going to be fun. I'm excited to talk to him. He's a big Beatles nut, so I got to ask him about the Get Back documentary. And he's played with and produced albums for Ringo Starr. So he's sort of in with them, as he's also in with the Stones. So we can pick his brain about cool people that we might want to know about. And it's going to be a barrel of fun. So let's ease on down the road.
Let's do it. Happy holidays, everybody. Happy New Year. And we will see you right back here on the other side.
Happy holidays, Emily.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Don Was, welcome to Inside the Hive.
Good to see you, Joe.
Yeah, I'm so happy to have you here. We just came in on a little Christmas tiding there from Duke Pearson.
Nice.
Merry old soul on the Blue Note record label. Don Was, you're president of Blue Note Records.
Yeah.
I brought you here because I'm a big fan of the music that your label produces, and I'm a big fan of records and jazz and soul and all kinds of music, and you are a legendary producer. Mm-hmm. I could list all the accolades that you've had: Grammys, you've worked with the Stones, Elvis Costello, John Mayer, you've played with Ringo Starr, which is amazing. You're a bass player. And we've talked so much about that Beatles documentary on this podcast. It's like
it's the greatest, isn't it? Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. And for you as a producer and a Beatles fan, just to, for all of us to see the creative process of these artists who we've revered and to see that curtain get pulled back, must have been, it's so exciting, right?
Well, it's mind blowing that the stuff that you hold in such high esteem, the music that, you know, meant so much to so many people, that the process that they go through is not that dissimilar to everybody else. And there's still intangible magic that's got to appear at some point. And it's remarkable with the Beatles to hear what they sound like before the magic hits and to dig the fact that they have the perseverance to stay with it until it occurs and take 38 is going to be where some of those were like, take 78.
You know, brutal.
That's going to be the one, you know, and it only has to happen one time. That's the, to me, that's the beauty of making records is you never know. And I get nervous and adrenalized before every single session, whether it's a 19-year-old making a record for the first time or the Rolling Stones, it's the same thing. You don't know what that intangible element is going to be that's going to transform everything. You just know if you stick with it, it'll happen. And your job is to be prepared to capture it at that moment, make sure the tapes are on and that kind of thing. But it's kind of cool to know that they went through the same things. In the same.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was so, so much anxiety and frustration and boredom and all these things that you... Yeah. Might not have associated or at all with those songs because you just only heard the end result. So, you know, the reason I brought you on here, I saw you, you know, going through videos as one does, looking at things that I was interested in. I saw an interview you did with Wayne Shorter. Mm. Wayne Shorter, of course, the legendary saxophone player, made many records on Blue Note. And I was thinking also about everything that's going on in the news and, you know, we have this surge in the pandemic and now, you know, what a bummer it is because suddenly you have to go back into thinking, being cautious and isolating. And I'm reading in the paper, you know, just mental health crisis in the country. And they the New York Times did a survey of like therapists all over the country, and they're like, "Oh my God, it's just off the charts. Everybody's flipping out," you know. Yeah. And I was thinking about how it is that I get through, you know. Mm-hmm. And I the reason I wanted to do this today is just to talk about, you know, music for me has been the survival, you know, to listen to music, to be with it, and I mean, obviously, this is your area of expertise, and you know what it can do and the power that it has for people.
Yes.
You know, for me in particular, I listen to records and the reason I love them is that you kind of have to pay attention to them, right? They're on a platter. You got 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're listening to your music on your Alexa or your iTunes or whatever, that's totally great. It's fine. Music is beautiful in any way you can get it. But it can sometimes fade in the background because you don't have to worry about it. But a record is something you have to pay attention to. And there's something mindful about listening to a record.
It's also physical. You know, you see that thing spinning around. I remember the first time I played vinyl on a turntable for my kids, my youngest kids who are now in their 20s.
Yeah.
And unlike, you know, we used to listen to music all the time. But there was no, you put a CD in the tray and push the tray in. You don't see any action. They're just like boxes with lights, right? But when I put the needle down on the turntable. We sat around staring at it like it was like we were sitting around a fire.
Yeah.
It's good. It's good to have it be like an action verb, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and one of the things I'm a guy who listens to a lot of jazz, and that jazz is a music that if you give it active listening, if you give it your attention, it really yields more than so many other, any art form to me. I get so much out of it. And it, it really is about attention and listening to other people, paying attention to each other. Because it's improvisatory. The artists are very much in tune with each other. But let's just get something straight right out of the gate is when I talk to people and I'm like, they ask me what kind of music I listen to, and I say jazz. It's a little test moment. It can be divisive. It can be people like, you know, they have cliches in their mind that make them feel a certain way, and you can't do anything about it. But what do you say to people who don't get jazz or they're a little like maybe uncertain about it?
Yeah, well, we encounter that a lot. Getting people to drop their preconceptions of it, that it's the province of like professors in corduroy suits smoking pipes and analyzing a bunch of musical gibberish, you know, that that's the misconception. We, at a few points here, we, you know, we've done market research just to find out what people think of jazz. And we'd find very often in these focus groups that you'd ask someone what they thought of jazz. Oh, I hate it. It's just a bunch of noise and a bunch of notes and all that. And then we put on The Sidewinder by Lee Morgan. And they go, oh, I love this. What do you call this music?
So
the challenge, above all else, has really been to inform people that it's not some elitist, exclusive music, but in fact, it's just conversation without words.
Yeah,
I liken it to going to a party. You know, you walk around, there are clusters of people, and you engage in different conversations. And sometimes you just don't want to hear any more of this conversation, and you move on. You know, but in jazz, you're going to find someone who leaps out of the speakers and touches you and is speaking to you without words. Those are the best musicians, I think. I don't care about how many notes you can play. I really believe that there are two different types of music. There's selfish music and there's generous music. Selfish music is some guy sitting there with a guitar who can cram 100 notes into a bar. And that's acrobatics. Yeah. You got to admire the practice that went into it. You got to admire the technique. But it doesn't make you feel anything. It's just like, wow, that's quite a trick. that's selfish music. But generous music is someone who's got emotions and feelings that are bursting out of them. And they dig deep inside to find the source of it. And they transform that into musical notes and put it out there. And you receive it. And you may not feel the same thing as the artist, but you're going to feel something. That's the definition of all art in any medium. It doesn't have to be music, you know. Someone feels something and expresses it, and you serve as the transducer, and you convert that back into emotion. Music that helps you make sense out of your life. It's tough being human, man. You know, we got a lot of crazy things. Forget pandemic. We don't know if we're going to die in the next 10 seconds. And we walk around with that knowledge. Our loved ones, we get fired, you know, people get divorced. Everyone's life, their lives are so unstable, man. You know, that's tough to deal with.
Yeah.
It's not easy being human. And I think music, at its best, helps you deal with it. Yeah. It makes you feel good. Very least, brings you comfort, but sometimes really changes your whole attitude towards life without a musician uttering a word. That's the beauty of jazz. You know, it, at its core, it's music that came over in the African diaspora, right? And people brought here against their will and not really allowed to celebrate their culture, and they had to come up with a hidden language to express, you know, their deepest feelings. And I think that's why it's so powerful, because, you know, imagine those circumstances and the depth of emotional turmoil that you're going through. If you can find an art form that expresses that, that's going to that's going to be a meaningful art form. And that's why jazz is popular all over the world, man. Like all these really disparate cultures, because that music speaks to something really deep inside. And I just hope people listen to it as conversation. That's the best jazz, is just someone talking, but there's no words. They're using, you know, an instrument to speak through. And you will, if you give it a moment, you will find something. There's going to be someone in there who means something to you. There's all kinds of music.
Yeah. I'm glad you settled that, and it rings so true. And it's one of the, you know, one way to approach it is to give it a chance and to put it on. And, you know, maybe a lot of people don't know where to start, you know. Well, that's what we're here today to help them also, because you brought some songs. Mm-hmm. And we're going to play some snippets of them. And I'm going to create a playlist on Spotify for people to go check out and sample this stuff and listen to it on their own time, which I'd recommend. You know, sometimes people call it deep listening. It doesn't have to be that deep. You just put it on and sit in front of it. And just listen to it.
It's not going to bite you.
It's not going to bite you. Well, and it's interesting because the first song that you queued up for me, mm-hmm. Mode for Joe.
Mm-hmm. By Joe Henderson.
Which, as I understand it, it was like kind of your conversion experience.
It applies directly to what we were just talking about.
Yeah.
It's the first real jazz I remember consciously hearing. I think I absorbed a lot of it peripherally in the 1950s as a young kid. But in 1966, I was 14, and I was driving around with my mom, she was making me run errands with her on a Sunday. And I didn't want to be there. I wanted to be hanging out at the mall with my friends. And so I was a crabby, unpleasant kid to be dragging around. And eventually she gave up on it. She left me in the car with the keys so I could play with the radio. And I went to the R&B station that I used to listen to, which is in Detroit, WCHB, 1440 AM. But they had a sister station, WCHD, on FM radio that no one had in 1966, really. It was mostly elevator music, Muzak, you know. And but WCHD broadcast jazz, and on Sundays they'd simulcast, so you could hear jazz on AM radio. And I landed on the station just as the saxophone solo from Mode for Joe was playing. And he just comes in with these anguished cries. I don't know how else to describe it. Whoa, man, it was so intense. But it actually matched my frustration at being stuck running errands on a Sunday. And whatever else was bugging me at 14, I can't even imagine what the problem was. But about 20 seconds into this, and we can play this section. It happens right at about a minute 26 or something into the song. There's this anguish solo. And then the drummer, Joe Chambers, who's currently still on the Blue Note roster making records for us. Wow. Joe Chambers kicks in with this swinging groove. And Joe Henderson kind of falls in line. And the message that came through to me as a 14-year-old was, Don, you got to groove in the face of adversity, right?
Yeah.
And it was so compelling that I listened to this thing and I got it. And by the time my mom came back to the car, I was a nice kid again. and then I was aware that this music had that effect on me. So I wanted to know more about it. I went out and got a portable FM radio so I could listen to it at home. And started learning about it. But we can play this Joe Henderson thing. You'll know exactly what I'm talking about.
Thank you. Love it. Yeah. Who's playing piano on that?
I think it's Cedar Walton, and he wrote the song. Yeah, I believe it's his composition. Yeah,
amazing. Yeah, I love Joe Henderson. Mm-hmm. I don't know how people listening out there, they've heard of Miles Davis, they've heard of John Coltrane, and they, you know, the big bold-faced names, but he's up there in the pantheon as one of the great tenors.
I agree.
Sax players. Now, a little later on in this list of tracks, and we could play it now, depending on how attached you are to the sequencing here. But
not at all.
You happen to have picked a song that was my entry into listening to this kind of music that really instantly made me a jazz fan and made me start listening. And that's "Maiden Voyage" by Herbie Hancock.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, I heard it like on headphones with a stack of CDs somebody had given me. And I, you know, just got so absorbed and involved in it. And as you can tell from it, has the Maiden Voyage is the title. It almost has in its arrangement and the melodies and the playing a kind of aquatic vibe to it, like you're descending down into like a submarine and going on some kind of Jacques Cousteau documentary, you know?
That's very interesting imagery. Just the fact that you could see that in there is testimony to the evocative powers of Herbie's writing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a great song to play as well, too. You know, it's fun for musicians. Well,
just the, and I've heard many covers of it over the years, and I've always liked them. And the opening of it is very iconic, right, for people that pay attention to such things. And people probably know Herbie Hancock from other eras of his career when he even had a pop hit, right?
Sure did.
And he's always been very advanced and experimental and worked with electronics and all kinds of other artists. And he's very just open, you know. Let's just listen to the first couple of sequences of this just to give people a sense of what we're talking about here. Love those long lines. Those long, beautiful horn lines.
You made me remember something when you were just listening to it now that I'd forgotten about. You know, he was a hero to me from the time I was a teenager. I bought this album basically when it was new, I think, you know, in the 66 or something like that. Later, you know, became quite friendly with Herbie. And one year he called me about, we had a mutual friend who was being honored by the ACLU. And so he said, will you come play this with me? Will you just come play with me to honor this guy at this you know, this banquet, right? So, of course, I was thrilled, but I was really nervous. And so I was trying to think of things that I could use to like throw him off balance as a musician. So I said, let's play a Bob Marley song. He said, look, I haven't got time to learn anything new. He said, just learn Maiden Voyage. And I was like, oh, Jesus, man. So I practiced. I just stopped what I was doing for about 2 weeks. And I actually called a friend of mine, a pianist in Detroit named Luis Resto. And we sat on the phone for hours just playing. I just wanted to burn those changes yeah. into my deepest subconscious. So I wasn't thinking, and I could really, first of all, I really wanted to enjoy the experience of playing Maiden Voyage with Herbie, but I also didn't want to embarrass myself.
Yeah, well, geez.
So we went to the day of the show, I went to the dentist, right? And they gave me some kind of barbiturate drink and Novocaine, and I was out of it, and they put headphones on, and they're playing Marvin Gaye, What's Going On. And I had the changes to Maiden Voyage so deeply enmeshed in my brain that I started singing the melody to What's Going On to the changes of Maiden Voyage. And wow. I thought, well, that'd be really cool. You know, if he gives me a solo, I'm going to play What's Going On.
Wow.
And you could do da 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 da. You know, you got to change the scale a little bit, but you can play some semblance of the melody. So sure enough, it happened. He just looks at me and play. So I start playing What's Going On, and then I had this wave of panic while I was into this because I could see he recognized it, and I thought, here, I'm taking my hero's signature piece. And super, what, I said, what if he hated Marvin Gaye? What if, like, Marvin hit on his wife or something?
Yeah, you never know.
You never know. And so then I was gripped by panic in the middle of it. But we got through it, and he picked up on it, and he started playing along, and it worked.
Wow.
So I asked him afterwards. I apologized after. I said, man, I probably shouldn't have just taken your song and done that to it. He said, no, you don't understand, man. Like, when I first got out to L.A., Marvin Gaye called me up. And he said, come over to the studio. And he went over to meet Marvin Gaye at the studio. And Marvin was sitting at the piano. And when he saw Herbie walk in, he played Maiden Voyage on the piano for him.
What?
And so he was transformed back to that. So it turned out to be
incredible.
A cool thing.
That was a poetic. That does pure poetry, that story. That's amazing. That's incredible. Wow. I can imagine your nerves, though. I mean, having to get into the shoes of Ron Carter, who's basically like the single most famous bass player in all of jazz.
Yeah.
Who, by the way, is still living, still working, and he's on Facebook all the time.
Yeah, he's great on that. Yeah, Instagram.
Yeah. He's on social media doing his thing. He's like right in the pocket, man.
America has a problem, one that is uniquely ours. On the new season of Long Shadow, I delve into the complicated history of firearms from the Second Amendment to the AR-15. I try to make sense of how we got here and how we might find a path forward. From Longlead, PRX, and Campside Media, in collaboration with The Trace, I'm Garrett Graff, and this is Long Shadow, In Guns We Trust. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
So you and I, were talking a little bit about, I was telling you that a record that I had been listening to recently was this Pete LaRocca, another Blue Note record.
Yeah.
It was Joe Henderson, who we played at the top, is on it. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's one of the things that you learn when you get into jazz is basically it's like, a lot of these people were mixing it up together and getting different conversations going, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this conversation I learned, this is an interesting example of how these records kind of never get old in a lot of ways, because you listen to them, you hear something new in them all the time, and mm-hmm. then sometimes you learn something about them that makes you listen to them in an entirely different way.
Mm-hmm.
And I told you I was listening to this Pete LaRocca. He was a drummer. I think this was his only Blue Note record.
He came back in the 90s and made a record for Blue Note.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. But this was made in the 60s, this Pete LaRocca record. And then you told me something, and as soon as you told me this piece of information, I went back and started listening to it again. So maybe you could just tell people what did we learn here?
Well, years ago, through a record producer named Hal Wilner, I met Carla Bley and Steve Swallow. And so I mentioned this record to Steve Swallow. And he said, you know, me and Pete, we dropped acid before that session.
Oh, my God. Which would, that's a special kind of inspiration, I guess you could call it.
Well, he said that the standout feature of the session for him was that, you know, Rudy Van Gelder, who is the great engineer who recorded most of our 1950s and 1960s catalog and gave it a really distinctive sound. You know a Blue Note record before you even know who the artist is. You can recognize that it's on Blue Note because he did some very specific things for Blue Note records. Yes. He was also a notorious germaphobe, right? So back in the 60s, before, it's very common now, but he put some blue disinfectant in the toilet bowls, right? And people didn't see that. So Steve Swallow and Pete DeRocca went back into the bathroom, and they were tripping on acid, and they saw the blue water in the toilet bowl, and they stood there and stared at it for like an hour. As he described that, I wasn't there, but it definitely gave me a great perspective on the album. It's a great record.
it's a fantastic record.
Says something about the correlation between psychedelic thinking and music.
Yeah. Just to talk about Rudy Van Gelder for a minute, there's a name that you'll see on the back of a lot of jazz records. It's an important name. Unless you're really steeped in this stuff, you might not know what it means. But as you said, he recorded so many amazing albums in his home in Englewood, New Jersey, and, later on in a studio that he built. But, we're talking about a guy that basically wore a lab coat, right? I mean, just he's a sound scientist, right?
He's an optometrist by trade, actually. He was an amateur audiophile who built his own equipment and started recording while he was a practicing optometrist, recording in his parents' living room. And you can see all these great pictures of Thelonious Monk and Miles Davis sitting, near the Venetian blinds and the lamps and all that.
Yeah.
And
all you kids out there who are, maybe you're unemployed living in your mom's house or your dad's house, come on, just build a studio right in the living room, bring over some musicians and start recording, man. You can become a legend.
You really can, yeah.
And you talked about the Blue Note sound and if you are somebody who's, a lot of people are going to get record players under their Christmas trees this year, right?
I hope so.
There's a huge revival in listening to records and listening to vinyl. I'm finding, kids my children's age, you're 14 years old, they're interested in it. They want to get a Taylor Swift on vinyl, right? Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, this is having this wild effect on the record business because there's only like a handful of pressing plants in the world. And, maybe you've read in the New York Times that Adele orders up 30,000 records and clogs up the entire system because there's not that many pressings.
We were victimized by that album.
Exactly. And it's a lovely record, but, on the vinyl front. And, but you're in the business of taking some of these old recordings that Rudy Van Gelder recorded and then preparing them for a new pressing, right? Mm-hmm. People out there listening, if they're on their streaming systems or Spotify or Apple, you'll see it says remastered, right? Yeah. And here we are talking to Don Was, somebody who does some of that. What is remastering? What does that mean to people?
Well, it means you take the master tapes and you can re-equalize them, which is essentially a very complex tone control. You can boost the treble or boost the bass or boost.
Yeah.
You can get more specific with it. You can also compress it a little bit, which kind of crushes the dynamics, but has an interesting byproduct of making cymbals go but I can tell you this, you can change the total character of a record with one false move. It's a really precarious undertaking. And you have to, at least in my opinion, you have to enter into it with a sense of great respect for the music that you're remastering. And also for the listeners who've come to know that music sounding a certain way. It's really arrogant, I think, to go into somebody else's music and think you're going to improve it, especially when that music has stood the test of time the way it was.
Yeah.
So when I first got the gig at Blue Note, we're coming up on a 75th anniversary, and we wanted to do a 75th anniversary vinyl reissue series. So I went out to Englewood Cliffs, and I met with Rudy Van Gelder, and I said, you know, what are we supposed to do? What's this actually supposed to sound like? Because I don't want to change it from what you did. I'd kind of like to get it back. Because over the years, people remaster all the time. So if you listen to, if you take the Maiden Voyage album, there are all these different incarnations of it that aren't necessarily marked as different incarnations, but someone remastered it for CD a couple of times. And they weren't always improvements. Right. Rudy Van Gelder, in fact, went back and remastered his own work, and they were not so great, man. That's the probably the last person you want to give a free hand to is someone who hears his youthful mistakes and wants to rewrite his history, because it may be those mistakes that make it great.
Yeah,
they're not perfect records, but they got a feel to them. Anyway, so we started doing it.
Pair of jeans with the holes in them, and you don't want to patch up the holes. So you like the jeans with the holes.
That's exactly right, man. That's exactly right. So it's I didn't do a very good job of it, to be honest with you. I was trying to match it to the sound of other records. Now we do our audiophile records with a guy named Joe Harley, who's a very well-known person in the audiophile world and is also a big fan of Blue Note Records. And he remasters with a guy named Kevin Gray. And they truly channel Rudy Van Gelder. They don't have to go back and compare it to the initial pressings. They know what he was doing as if they did it themselves. They've been doing it for a long time. And they also understand things about different presses. Certain brands of vinyl presses sound more conducive to Blue Note Records than other ones do. So they're very finicky about the plant and the plating and who's doing the work. They're like 12 steps. It's not like AA, but there just happen to be 11 or 12 steps where you really can impact the way a record sounds. And you have to be careful, and you have to have knowledge of all the different aspects of it. And they do now. So I'm very proud of the vinyl we're putting out now.
Yeah.
And fans, especially Blue Note fans, they can be finicky and highly vocal about
absolutely.
I learned the hard way, man. You got to get it right. And I'm proud of what we're doing.
You don't want to. There's some record shop owners I know that, you know, they'll get up in your grill about different remastering and different sounds of different things. For people out there who, you know, are thinking a lot of this is archival music.
Yeah.
A lot of music that is from the past, and maybe they want to feel more like they're with it. And that's, you know, and then there's even a bigger adventure trying to figure out modern jazz, which is like a whole other beast, right? Mm-hmm. And you have all kinds of interesting people. But there's a record you guys put out this year that I really have come to appreciate and love that is sort of a merger of the two. And that's the Micaiah McRaven.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, good.
Record, yeah.
Yeah.
So he's this drummer from Chicago, young guy, incredibly talented drummer and multi-instrumentalist. And he was given access to sort of the Blue Note archives, it appears, like mm-hmm. to listen to these classic records by Art Blakey and the Jazz mm-hmm. Messengers and you know, a record with Elvin Jones on drums, and then mm-hmm. take that music and then integrate his own band into it to create mm-hmm. like a third thing.
Mm-hmm.
And with much more hip hop kind of injected into it.
Yeah.
This has been done before by other artists in the 90s. There was Blue Note has a history of kind of opening up its archive to allow this mm-hmm. kind of thing. But this is a really successful version of it, I have to say. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to quickly play a little sample of that for the people and then ask you about it. This is the last track on that record, and it's just – you can't not groove to this because it's just so killer. We'll be right back. find this record under your Christmas tree, you're going to be very happy on Christmas, because that is a really wonderful record. And I would say kind of a great gateway into thinking about listening to jazz, because you kind of get in touch with the classic stuff, but also this with this modern sensibility. So tell us a little bit about some of the newer artists that are coming onto Blue Note. And we have, there's some in your list here we can touch on too.
Yeah, but well, when I first got the gig, one of the first task was to go back and identify what it was about Blue Note music over the 75 years that preceded me, you know, that that made the music remain relevant and vibrant after a long period of time. But you listen to old Blue Note records, it's not like you're going back to a museum or something, you know. Yeah. They still speak to you.
Yeah.
So what was going on there? And what I found was that in every era, the founders of the company chose artists who were pushing the threshold of what was already, you know, of what the popular music was of their era, and also reflecting the times that they lived in.
Yeah.
So every step of the way, they recorded Thelonious Monk in 1948. They could have picked any jazz musician, and they chose the guy who at that point in time was certainly the most challenging, innovative musician, completely reworking, you know, the harmonies and the way you accompany the soloist and what a solo consisted of. He changed everything, but he wasn't popular in 1948. It took about 15, 20 years for people to catch up to him. Just beginning with him, man, it changed the records he made for Blue Note in the late 40s changed everything and impacted the way every subsequent musician made music. Then, you know, 5 years later, he put Art Blakey and Horace Silver together to form the Jazz Messengers, which introduced elements of funk and a backbeat and kind of gospel funky piano over a bebop setting. And that became super popular. And you go to the label in the 60s, and you had guys like Herbie and Wayne Shorter, and you had Ornette Coleman and Eric Dolphy on the label. Even the commercial artists like Jimmy Smith. To me, Jimmy Smith was a revolutionary. He did things with a B3 that no one on earth had ever done. Even though the music's very accessible, you have to realize that he did that first. And also thematically, what people dealt with. You know, Art Blakey, Free For All, was reflecting the anger and the resentment in the air around, you know, preceding the passage of the Civil Rights Bill in 1964. Black Rhythm Happening, which, you know, we just played a sample of it, is a revolutionary album that goes a little bit underappreciated, I would say. I'm really glad Makai chose that. And that reflects a kind of sensibility of, you know, of 1970s black nationalism that I think is a really important thing that was going on sociologically that comes through in the music. Well, by that same token then, the musicians who are making music now, anyone who's under 40 years old grew up listening to hip-hop. You can't miss it. You can't. You had to be in a vacuum. If you're going to be a relevant musician to the times that you live in, as opposed to someone who's just repeating stuff that happened 50 years ago, that's going to turn up in your music. So the music that the most vibrant players today are making, you know, they understand the fundamentals of what came before, but they're doing something brand new with it, which I think is what Blue Note Records has been about and the reason that the music's endured for 82 years. So a really good example of that is Robert Glasper. About a month into me having the gig as president of the label, I met Robert, and he came in to play very rough mixes of what was to become an album called Black Radio. That really, he wasn't the first person to put elements of hip-hop and jazz together, but he did it in a really unique way. He's got his own way of doing it. And he played me bits of this album, man, and I was transported somewhere else. I felt like, this is really exciting. I've never heard anything like this before, which is a hard thing to accomplish these days, because we've heard almost everything. This thing blew my mind when he played it for me. And it became super successful. And, you know, he did a version of Mago Santa Maria's song, Afro Blue, that Coltrane recorded. And if you go to, like, any high school jazz band concert today or go to a student concert at, Berklee School of Music or something like that, invariably someone gets up, one of the students' bands gets up and says, we'd like to play a Robert Glasper song right now called Afro Blue. And he just has impacted the way young people approach the music. His impact, I think, when time passes, will be viewed as to be as significant as Charlie Parker's influence or Coltrane's influence. He really changed the way everyone approached this music. We could play that if you want.
Well, yeah, I was going to say that just as an introduction too, Erykah Badu is on it, and seems like she wrote some lyrics to it. And that's like a whole new layer on this classic tune. So I'll just play it right from the open and we'll give it a little sample here. Beautiful.
Well, let's just go back to what we talked about at the beginning about it being conversation, right?
Yeah.
So if you and I are just having a free-form conversation, we're going to talk about experiences that we've had and things that have passed through our lives. And it's either going to be an interesting conversation to you or it's not going to be, but we talk about what we've absorbed, right?
Yeah.
Well, musicians are the same way. So Robert is a guy, I've gone to see him play, and he's quoted, you know, he knows I'm sitting there, so he plays I Can't Make You Love Me by Bonnie Raitt. He'll quote some lines and incorporate that into a solo. But in the same solo, he'll play a bit from a McDonald's commercial and a bit from J. Dilla and a bit from Monk. I mean, I've literally seen him combine J. Dilla and Monk in a solo. So you reflect your experience, and if you've had interesting experiences, you're going to make interesting music. And I think that's what it's all about, is keeping the conversation real. I'm not that interested in young musicians who want to go back and recreate 1960s music, because they weren't there. They're not going to get it exactly right. They're probably going to miss the true essence of it. I'm interested in musicians who approach it the same way that Wayne and Herbie did in the 60s, who approach music with a completely open mind and want to do something that hasn't been done before. But do it as yourself. Be the strongest, most communicative version of you. And Robert pulls that off as well as any musician who's ever sat behind a piano.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're reminding me of a year ago, I had John Batiste on this program. Yeah. And, you know, he grew up like not only learning jazz and New Orleans style jazz. He was also playing like the theme songs from the video games that he was playing, right?
Yeah.
He was really absorbing things from all directions. And that's partly what's exciting about this conversation. It's like it's constantly percolating with what is happening, right? And
with what is
happening. About the the Micaiah McRaven thing is very much like it's both, it's like an interpretation of history. It's got the feeling of like the fallout from Black Lives Matter movement and the summer of last year before. And yet it's trying to understand how that relates to the long story of jazz. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I kind of love that. And now there's another Blue Note record that is really beautiful by, an older journeyman sax player Charles Lloyd.
Mm-hmm.
He's been like having a renaissance, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
As of late, and he's a really interesting guy. I've read some interviews with him in the British newspapers, and he's really a funky, soulful dude.
Oh yeah, he's the greatest. Yeah.
Yeah, and he made a record with like Lucinda Williams on it. Mm-hmm. Right, which is not yep. that's talk about a left turn, you know.
Yep.
But what a wonderful concept. So maybe you can tell me a little bit about and our listeners, like what this about this artist and about how this record came together.
Well, Charles is in his 80s now, right? And and yet miraculously is at the peak of his powers as a musician. Yeah. He's a beautiful tone. He's playing better than he ever played in his life. I can't think of any parallels, actually, to someone in their 80s who's at peak performance level, right?
Amazing.
And I'm a fan of his going back to the 1960s. Charles Lloyd was the first jazz artist to understand what was going on in alternative rock and roll music. And he played at the Fillmore, you know, like opening for the Grateful Dead and Paul Butterfield, right. And way before Miles went to the Fillmore, you know, like,
yeah.
When I say wait, you know, back then a couple of years was a huge difference, right? Yeah. And he had one of the first million-selling jazz albums with Forest Flower that he kind of brought a rock and roll band ethos to jazz. He wasn't playing rock and roll, but and he came from a really wild background in Memphis, where he not only played with jazz musicians but played with Howlin' Wolf and ran into Elvis as a young man and stuff like that.
Yeah, Elvis saw his band, yeah.
Yes, yeah. So he's been a hero of mine. When I first got the gig, I just cold called him. I'd never met him. I didn't know him. And I called and I talked to his wife for a while. And they were signed to ECM. And you can't poach. You can't, you know, it's really unethical. It might be illegal, actually, to offer someone a con. But I just let him know that I was a big fan. And then when he left ECM, they called up. And I've just been so thrilled to get to know Charles. He's one of a kind, super interesting cat, very spiritual guy, very streetwise guy at the same time, a unique blend. And his there's something in his tone. You know, the last album is called Tone Poem. And that's really, he is a tone poet. You know, he's, if music is conversation, his conversation is poetry, right? And having to do with the sonics of his tone, it's so soothing. And he was very interested in making some records that reflected the musical jambalaya that he grew up in the middle of in Memphis, which I could relate to because I grew up in the middle of the same thing in Detroit, with all kinds of styles colliding. So he formed this band, The Marvels, with Bill Frisell and Greg Lease and Reuben Rogers and Eric Harland, who've been playing with him for years, those two. And one night Lucinda came and sat in with him. I happened to be at that show. It was in Santa Barbara. And I've produced Lucinda Williams records before, as has Greg Lease, who was playing pedal steel in the band. And Bill's played on her records over the years. So it was a very natural thing. And they just clicked, man. They did a version of Masters of War. It was beautiful. We put it out on the day Trump was inaugurated.
Wow. Yeah.
And it was just came from that show. And then the chemistry was so good, we did a whole album.
Wow. That was then, therefore, the best thing that happened on that day. That's really something. I'd love to listen to a little sample of this. Why don't we?
Let's do it. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
only play so much of that here on the podcast, but boy, yeah. I could just listen to that whole thing from beginning to end. What a amazing.
It was incredible. You know, she was supposed to sing it, but she got to the session late that day. And so they were just running through it to make sure they knew the changes and everything. And that happened. And it was like, all right, there won't be a vocal on this one. The vote, yeah, Charles is going to be the vocalist. Yeah,
incredibly beautiful. I want to just say this also, that one of the things I love about jazz music, you know, I grew up listening to, you know, metal, punk, Kiss, right? I grew up with all kinds of alternative music of all kinds. And, you know, there's a music for every season of your mm-hmm. life, right? But jazz is something, because of the way it's made and the kind of communication that we've been talking about, is it's a lifelong art form. You know, it's a journey. And some of the great artists that people have heard of, just maybe by name, they might not know the music, but Duke Ellington and Count Basie, these people played until the day they died, right? Yeah. And some of their greatest works were done when they were older.
Yep.
And there's something really, I find really kind of wise and educational about that. Like, there's something you can learn from the fact that a guy like Charles Lloyd can sound that good and be that mm-hmm. soulful. And in fact, all the layers of his life are adding to what that sound is, right?
Exactly right.
Yeah. I mean, you can't say the same thing for like other kinds of music necessarily, like an 80-year-old playing punk rock. Maybe, but it's just not the same, right? It doesn't express what is actually happening in some ways. But
I've produced the Stones for 30 years, you know, and I know people have attachments to the early records, as do I, you know. But I think that a lot of what they do, what they've done in the last 20 years, is overlooked.
Yeah,
and I think that's remarkable. Did you see them on this last tour, man?
I did. Know, yeah.
Yeah, it's vibrant, man.
They're
kind of changing what it means to be closing in on 80 years old.
Yeah. Well, I loved Blue and Lonesome with their blues cover
thank
album.
You
produced that, and you know, kind of got to the heart of it because they, you know, when they were just kids. Their heroes were basically their age, and you know, or at least getting on to there. And similarly, the blues can be something that, you know, as you get different layers of your life on, you get more textured and interesting as a blues singer. I don't know if our listeners have heard of all of these artists, so I hope you're taking notes. But if you're not taking notes, I'm going to tell you about a playlist you can look up on Spotify, and I'm going to post about it on social media. And you can go to it, and when you're at your holiday function with your family and you just want to change the mood of the room, or maybe you want to get into another room by yourself and get away from your family, you can also do that. And you can pull up this Inside the Hive holiday special playlist that I'm going to post up. It's going to have some of the tunes and some other ones that we haven't gotten a chance to play. The Hand Selected by Don Was, this legendary producer. I'm just so grateful that you're on this program right now talking to this. It's an indulgence for me. You know, we're usually talking about the news on this
thing. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, it's a news-oriented show.
Well, you're very knowledgeable, man. You know, I'm impressed. I wouldn't have known that it wasn't a musical theme show because I like what you're saying. I agree with all of it, actually.
Well, you know, music is my great passion in life outside of my journalism day job. And whenever I get a chance to bring it into the fold, I do. I'll tell you a little shop secret here. On Inside the Hive I've profiled some people for our magazine for Vanity Fair. Mm-hmm. I profiled Beto O'Rourke. Mm-hmm. And Beto O'Rourke is a big music fan. And I remember I went to his house, and he had like a Stan Getz record on the turntable. He had a turntable. And he had a record collection, which he said was mostly his dad's that he had inherited, but he was trying to expand it. And one of the sort of tokens of our exchange was that I gave him a record and it was an Art Pepper record called Living Legend, which is one of my favorite albums. Mm. And then this article came out, and the article caused him some indigestion because he was running for president. And it caused a big stir, and people know that story. Mm. But a year later, I texted him, and I said, "Hey, man, just wanted to catch up with you, see what you're doing. And I hope there's no hard feelings about how things played out with, you know, your presidential run and everything." He's like, "No, man, it's fine." He was very gracious. Mm-hmm. And he said, "No, but you know what? That record you gave me is like the best thing I've heard in the last couple of years."
That's awesome.
And, and I was like, "Oh, I'm so," I felt like, wow, all is forgiven for sure. I mean, that felt great. And not that I needed his forgiveness, but I just was happy that we could have that little exchange. And
that's really important. Yeah.
And, you know, when I'm out there in the world, I find that people, I meet people, and even if we're talking about politics and the state of the world, we can have a little side conversation about music, because it's a passion that connects a lot of people. And in this crazy world that we're living in right now, God, we could use anything we can get to connect, right?
That's it. Yeah.
And I hope that that's why I brought you on here for this holiday thing, is like that special is just this week, this holiday week, is so that we can think about ways to kind of like reconnect with our humanity and reconnect with, you know, things that kind of turn off the world and turn on something inside of us instead, which is, I think we could use a lot more of that nowadays.
Here, here. Yeah. That's good.
So, like, two of the biggest artists on your label we haven't even talked about. So let's do that for a minute, because one of the songs you queued up here is "Daybreaks" by Norah Jones. Now, Norah Jones, she's on in my house all the time right now because she makes so many beautiful Christmas songs. But you put a track on here. Tell me a little bit about your, you know, knowing her and what her story is.
Well, I love Norah, man. You know. She's obviously been the most successful artist in the history of the label. And her success has underwritten a lot of great music that probably wouldn't have gotten made if we didn't have some of that in the coffers, you know. And every jazz music, she's the patron saint of Blue Note jazz, really.
Wow.
But also an incredible artist. You know, as a record producer, I learned that I think of the line that the speakers are at the end of the recording console. Think of that as like a 50-yard line in a football game. Yeah. And who can jump across the speaker line and actually come down and get close to the goal? It's to jump out of the speakers. It's being audiogenic. That's the word I use for it. It's like Claudia Schiffer. She looks great. She jumps off the page. You turn to the page she's on, and whoa, fuck! And it draws your attention to the jeans that she's advertising.
That's right.
Or whatever. You know? Yeah. So audiogenic is the same thing. I experienced it for the first time with producing Garth Brooks. Who I will admit that I was in the studio with him, but I didn't fully understand why he was the biggest artist in the world till he stepped up to the microphone for the first time. And he leapt out of the speakers so far that it was almost like he was behind me. Wow. And I don't know what that is. He doesn't know what it is. I've worked with other singers who have that kind of charisma. Mick Jagger's one. Aretha Franklin is one.
Wow.
But they just leap out so far. And it's some combination of huge personality and charisma and some physics. I don't know. Norah Jones has got that. And that's a reason that Come Away With Me album has sold, you know, whatever it is, 30 million records or something.
Yeah.
She's just got this incredibly warm, beautiful voice, and she's just got this incredible gift. And what I love most about her is that she could have kept making that record over and over and over and over again, and toured it for the rest of her life, and everyone would have been thrilled every year. But she's constantly trying to push the boundaries of what she does. When we celebrated the 75th anniversary of the label a few years back, we had a big concert at the Kennedy Center that drew, you know, we had, you know, all the old artists, the legendary Lou Donaldson was there playing with Dr. Lonnie Smith and McCoy Tyner and Bobby Hutcherson. And Nora played with Wayne Shorter, who's also, you know, on the label and began his career recording for Blue Note with, I think, the greatest records that we've ever released. To me, Speak No Evil by Wayne is the crown jewel of the catalog. Yeah. And they hadn't played together before. And it was so powerful, man. I remember I emceed the show, so I was just sitting in the wings. And when they played together, something incredible was unleashed. And I got really choked up. There were tears in my eyes from it. And it wasn't that I felt sad. It was just I felt like I was something grand about the universe was being revealed. Okay, two incredible artists playing together. So after the thing, I don't normally tell people what I think they should do. I assign artists we trust and we let them do their thing. Right? But I did mention casually to Nora, like, I'd be very interested in hearing an album of that collaboration. And she heard it. And she went out and made that record. And she called Wayne and I love what they did together.
Should we listen to a little bit of it here?
Let's do it.
Night breaks in your head and you're finally alone. I'll find a way to make it through, but it keeps raining.
How old is Wayne Shorter?
He's 86, I think.
Wow. Again, kind of an amazing thing. I mean, I think that if I could impress upon people listening to this podcast one thing, is just what an amazing, of all the things that are going on in the world, to have these legends still among us needs to be acknowledged. And you should really go check out. Of course, you got to Speak No Evil, one of my favorite records, which is a high water mark in his career, of course. But I mean, he's still playing beautifully, and he's playing with modern artists, and he's vital, and he's making an opera with Esperalda Spalding. I mean, the guy's as you know, on top of it as he's ever been, and that's so inspiring.
He's one of a kind, and
and so great. In that case, we have a conversation between the young and the old, right? You've got another record which we didn't get to talk about, but Dr. Lonnie Smith, this great organ player with this beautiful turban on his head, like a beautiful man, interesting, almost like a wizard type character, and he's playing with Iggy Pop. Right, which is one that you didn't expect to hear about, right? What a strange merger. Just briefly tell me how that even came together.
Well, I'm from Detroit, so Stooges played at my high school, and I ended up producing Iggy. We've done a couple of albums together. And we did something in Detroit maybe 8 years ago. It was for the Grammy Museum, and we were interviewed, and we played a couple songs together. And after the thing, he pulled me aside in the dressing room. He said, there's something I really want you to do for me. I said, yeah, of course, for anything, man. He said, I love Dr. Lonnie Smith. I want to record something with him. Like, great. And it took a little while to get it organized, but we all went to Florida and went into Criteria Studios one day, and we cut three tracks, and the chemistry was incredible. It was the most unlikely pairing, but they really clicked, and it's all live, all happened in the room and on this one day. And so the three of the songs are included in his new album.
Wow.
And I'm really glad Dr. Lonnie passed about a month ago. And,
oh, my God. I didn't even know that. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, no, it's a shame, man. He is another one. One of a kind, absolutely. And really innovative musician on the instrument. And just, he played bass with the pedals, on the B3. And he was one of the funkiest bass players I ever heard in my life. Put him right up there with Bootsy Collins.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that's the beautiful thing about listening to organ music is you don't often, they don't need a bass, right? They're working it out on the left hand.
Yeah.
I'm so into this. I could have you here probably for another hour, but I know you're a busy man, you got a schedule. Let's talk about lastly about Gregory Porter. I remember a couple of years ago going over to my brother-in-law's house and him pulling it out, and he's like, you got to hear this. Nah. He was just, and then you hear that voice. This guy's got just one of the most great voices. And like a lot of classic jazz icons, has an interesting chapeau on his head. Mm-hmm. He wears a funky hat. You need that,
Yeah.
And but tell me, did he come into the label while you were running it, or did he?
I got the job at the label because of Gregory Porter.
Uh-huh.
I was in New York, going on 11 years ago now, and I was producing an album for John Mayer called Born and Raised. And we took one night off, and I looked through the Village Voice just to see what was going on. And I saw that Gregory was appearing at a little club called Smoke, almost up near Harlem, right?
Yeah, I know that one.
And I heard him on the radio. It was one of those things where I was driving and I heard this track of his, and I'd never heard of him before. And I was just blown away. I had to pull a car over. And I just thought he's one of the most expressive singers. I didn't know why he wasn't the most famous guy in the world, right? I Shazammed him and went out and bought that album, which is his first album. There's a song called Illusion that's on a first album called Water. It's just like just a brilliant composition and such a riveting vocal. So I went to see him at Smoke, and I sat through all three sets just drinking coffee and eating ribs. And I wasn't there on business. I wasn't trying to hustle anything. I was just there to dig it. And I stayed all night and just had the most wonderful time. The next morning, I was having breakfast with an old buddy of mine, a guy named Dan McCarroll, who I knew as a drummer who played with Sheryl Crow in the 90s. And his wife, Jane, was my assistant in the 90s. And he had risen through the ranks and was now president of Capitol Records.
Holy
and we mold. Just, we weren't even talking about business or anything over breakfast. But at the very end, when we got up to split, I said, wait, is Blue Note Records still part of Capitol Records? Because if it is, you should sign this guy I saw last night. And unbeknownst to me, Bruce Lundvall, who had been the president of Blue Note for about 30 years and just was one of the most beloved guys in the music business and a real visionary, beautiful cat, he was not well, and he had to retire, and they were looking for someone who would take the legacy of the label forward. And right then, I said, you should sign this guy. And he said, no, you should. And he offered me the gig at Blue Note.
Holy shit. That is one fortuitous breakfast, man.
It was a really monumental breakfast and really life-changing. But the first call I made, obviously, when I signed the contract, was to Gregory's manager.
Wow. Amazing.
And he's just I just can't believe that we get to work with someone that great in his prime like that. He's just, he gets better and better with each record. And I've seen him play now, you know, 30, 40 times, and I'm just slayed every single time.
Wow. Here, let's have a little sample here.
Good.
Hey, Laura, it's me. Sorry, but I had to ring your doorbell so late. But there's something bothering me. I really am sorry, but it just couldn't wait. Is there someone else instead of me? Go ahead and lie to me and I will believe. You're not in love with him and this fool can see that the rivers of your love flow uphill to me. Hey, Laura, it's me.
Oh, man, that is beautiful.
Yeah.
Damn.
Nice, yeah.
It's just the soul is dripping off that guy.
Yeah. Oh,
that's
yeah.
That's so wonderful. And there's a little sort of like shading of Bill Withers in there that I really mm-hmm. am just, that that's hits the spot for me. Yeah, that really does it for me.
Yeah.
Get him on the, you know, get him to cover Grandma's hands, man. That's like, that's right.
I think
right
he's done it. I've seen him sing it. Yeah, I've seen
is
him
that
do
right?
it live. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's a great. Yeah, no. Oh, God. Good. I love that song.
I should offer you a gig as an A&R man at Blue Note Records. That's
I'm here for you. I'm here
call.
For you, Don. That is stupendous, I got to say. I just want to say how grateful I am that you came on. You know, it's treasure for me. It's really a birthday, Christmas present, I should say. It's a Christmas present for me and or holiday present or whatever it is. It's the solstice. We're going into the long, we came out of the long dark and we're going into the light. And that's what the whole season's about at the end of the day. And for me, music is light. And, you know, it's something I hope people have enjoyed, and I know I've enjoyed it. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me, man. I've had a really good time. You run a tight ship here, man. Very good.
I don't know. We're going to have to talk to my producer about it. But to you out there in the holiday land, enjoy the holidays and happy new year. Let's go into 22 with, you know, taking our optimism where we can get it and hope and pray for the best and be safe out there. Take care of your brothers and sisters, and let's do it.
Let's do it.
That's our podcast this week. I'd like to thank Don Was for coming on this program. A very special episode indeed. Thanks to the producer of this program, Brett Fuchs. Thanks to the people at Cadence 13. If you like what you're hearing, stay tuned for 2022. It's going to get hot. Hit subscribe. Please support our sponsors the way they support this program, and we'll see you in 2022.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake at The New Yorker, to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.